Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Wherever you are, I'm Alan Stoga, chairman of the Tilburg Foundation, and I'm going to host this meeting today. As I think everyone in the world knows, Donald Trump has been president for 5 weeks now. In light of the blizzard of executive orders, funding cuts, hiring cuts, endless nominations and appointments, even to the Kennedy Center board, and above all, the nonstop controversial policy declarations on every imaginable topic, and some which literally are unimaginable, I should probably clarify. Trump has been president for only 5 weeks. We've got 47 more months to go. No president has ever started with this much activity, with this much shock and awe, for better and for worse. Usually you wait to the 100-day mark, the famous 100-day mark, to think about where is this administration going. But it's already clear that Trump intends to change how, not only how Washington works and how the country works, but how the whole world works. So I think it's important to ask today, what the hell is going on in the United States? To answer that question, I've invited two guests. Aziz Huq teaches constitutional law at the University of Chicago, publishes widely on constitutional issues, on regulatory issues, including AI, and on democracy. Scott Miller is a leading strategist for businesses, politicians, and governments in the U.S. and globally, and some even pay their bills. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Aziz, for doing this. I should tell our audience that I deliberately invited two people whose approach to the issues we're going to talk about probably couldn't be more different, and whose conclusions are also likely to be radically different. At least I hope so. Aziz, I'd like to start with you. You recently wrote that every president tests the limit of his authority, but that none have ever started by going as far as Donald Trump. What's unique about Trump's opening gambit?
Thanks, Alan. That's a great question, and thank you for including me in this. One way of identifying the distinctiveness of the second Trump presidency is by focusing upon the nature of the legal claims that he makes on behalf of the presidency. And to my mind, the distinctive phase shift in those legal claims is in relation to the extent to which the American presidency is bound by statutes that Congress has passed. It has long been the case that American presidents have raised targeted objections to particular statutory constraints, particularly in the foreign affairs domain. By contrast, the first month of the Trump administration has been characterized along a number of fronts by wholesale rejections of Congress's authority to stipulate the institutional shapes through which government acts and the end to which government acts. So one way of understanding the legal radicalism, and this may not be the way in which the administration is radical on the ground, but one way of understanding its legal radicalism is its repudiation of the shared tripartite branch model of the American Constitution, the idea that there's an executive, a Congress, and courts, in favor of a plebiscitary model of government.
I want to come back to some of those issues in a moment, but let me ask just one quick follow-on. Part of the, at least in layman's terms, the argument that the administration is making is that the president is, they use a CEO framing. He's the CEO of the, he's the executive of the government. Therefore, like any executive, He has this power to hire and fire, to do or not do, to spend or not spend. And as you just said, that is, that conceptualization is a radically different conceptualization of I think, the prior 40, depending how you count his first term, prior 46 presidencies. So Aziz, quick response.
I think that's right. The way that I would think about it is that in ordinary democracy, there are two sources of legitimate authority. One is a legislative body that creates laws, and those laws are meant to be durable. Those laws are meant to last over time. They're meant to last beyond the lifetime, in particular, of the coalitions and the parliaments and the congresses that create them. On the other hand, there, at least in a presidential system, is a separate executive who has a separate source of legitimate authority, which is the election. And the distinctive thing about the second Trump administration is the blanket refusal to recognize the first source of authority as opposed to the second source of authority. And I think that there are contrasts or interesting parallels in the corporate law domain. But to my mind, I think you can understand this in terms of the ordinary push and pull of politics being distorted in a new way.
Scott, let me go to you, but frame, I think, the same issue slightly differently. Trump not only says I'm the CEO of the government, but he says he was elected to change how America works and to do so in really fundamental ways. I guess the several part question, do you agree that that's what he thinks he was elected to do? And do you think that the 77 million people that voted for him agree that that's what he ought to be doing?
I don't know if Trump actually captured the full power of the change vote. Or the full desire of the public for change. At the time of the election in the New York Times Siena poll, 75% of American voters of all demographics said that the country was on the wrong track. 63% said that we needed radical change from the Biden administration. And my own company's research, Armada's research from a couple of years ago, said that 84%, and it's fluctuated over the years, but 84-85% of all voters of all demographics believe that an elite of incumbent politicians of both parties, lobbyists, big banks, big unions, big business, big special interests, and big media in Washington rigged the system to protect their own power and prestige. That is a mandate for fairly radical change. I'm not sure, frankly, that Trump even got the full power of that vote because he's Trump. But there's a powerful mandate for change, and I think there's reverence for the Constitution in a kind of an abstract way, but for the way things are going, what people call the system, the political system, they think is totally broken.
So Aziz, if a majority of the people think things are broken, how does what Trump's doing speak to that? Is it coherent with that by attacking business as usual? Does that accomplish this? Does it at least give the sense of radical change? And again, it's early. We don't know where things are going. We only know where they've started.
I agree with Scott's diagnosis of public sentiment. And I agree with the idea that there is a widely shared view of the status quo being locked in stalemate and being resistant to the interests and demands of a substantial tranche of the public. And I'd flag that there's really good political science evidence for that sentiment that dates back a number of decades now in a number of different bodies of work, Bartel's work, Martin Gillen's work, that demonstrates that in the United States, both state and national politicians are and have for a long time been responsive to the interests of a relatively narrow slice of the income distribution. So, for example, when the views of people in anything below the top 20% of the income distribution change on a public policy matter, it is exceedingly rare, at least it has been historically, for public policy or for politicians' votes to change. So absolutely, there's a broadly shared sense of the political system and the economic system, which I would add to Scott's account, being unresponsive. And absolutely, there's a sense in which what Trump is doing is picking up on what one might characterize as that vibe, that broadly shared sentiment, and acting upon it. I think that the detail that I would add is that the consensus that Scott describes is a consensus that lies on top of a profound polarization of the American public. The polarization is unusual in American history in that it divides along partisan lines, right? That's not always been the case. It certainly wasn't the case for much of the 20th century. And the polarization comes with very different accounts or understandings of the causes of the stalemate, the logjam in American politics. Comes with, I think, very different diagnosis and prescriptions for that logjam. So one can have a situation in which there is a broad set of discontents, in which there is a multiplicity, a variety of different diagnoses and desires for breaking out of the logjam. And you can have a candidate that promises and then delivers a form of change. The change that's delivered may or may not be responsive to one or another diagnosis of the status quo's problems. It also may or may not be responsive to the extent to which people have been historically locked out of government or locked out of political power by extant elites. And one question I think that's worth asking is, to what extent are the set of policy and personnel changes associated or that we've seen over the last month in fact locking in or locking out political elites and changing the nature of responsiveness of American government to popular demand?
Let me pick up on that and then, Scott, ask your comment. I saw a Gallup poll this week which looked at 30 major issues, almost all domestic. The results were that in 17 of those issues, the gap between over the issue was at least 20%. And as you've just said, Aziz, almost always along party lines, and really quite radical differences, 30, 40% differences in views. So you do have this overlap of partisan politics and perceptions on issues, which is unique. We have that partisanship. Trump is both a cause and a consequence, in my judgment, of that. Scott, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely true, and I don't dispute the radical differences that exist. I would say, however, the numbers I cited would say that the American people agree very strongly with each other about this system and how it's working for them. In the 2024 election, maybe 55-56% of voters were working class, which means they have less than $100,000 income and no college degree. And those people are affected, obviously, by all the issues that turned the election, inflation particularly, and immigration as a perception, and security and crime, those things. The need for fairly radical change is widespread. When we, in 2016, in our research, we found that what we call the Bernie brothers, the Bernie Sanders' hardest supporters and the MAGA strongest supporters of Trump were almost shoulder to shoulder on the issues. They were radical, but they wanted to see very radical change. Now, the uniting idea would be reform. And Aziz makes the good point, is this reform, or is it just, are we just breaking things? And time will tell, but it'll have to produce again. And this may be part of the reason for all of the action so fast. It's going to have to produce results fairly quickly. If the working class does not sense that their economic security and personal and family security and is being recognized, being advanced, the Republicans and Trump will be in trouble.
I checked the White House website last night, and so far in his term, the president has issued 70 executive orders. That is far and away a new record. At this time in his first term, he had issued only 13. So this governing by decree, it is a powerful tactic. It is across an enormous range of issues. It's almost daily that there are new executive orders signed. Aziz, that is an approach that other presidents have taken, but never this intensity. And it does lead in a direction that challenges, as you said, starts, and we'll get to the judicial issues in a minute. It starts pushing up against not just change, but whether or not it's change within the system or actually changing the system itself. Do you see it in those terms?
I think that the wave of executive orders, which you're absolutely right, Alan, are different in scale rather than in kind from earlier presidencies, including Trump Wang. To my mind, is distinctive for two reasons, neither of which have much to do with their volume. Indeed, I would say that in sorting wheat from chaff, one should ignore the volume and focus upon the nature of the claims and the vision of government that is being described in the executive orders. And I would say that there are two elements of the executive orders that are genuinely distinctive and worthy of attention. Once one strips away what is, I think, a lot of performance or material that is intended to maintain the White House in the public eye rather than to shift public policy. The first of them is the one that I have mentioned, which is the persistent disregard of statutory authority or the lack of statutory authority across the different executive orders. Here's just one example from an area that's actually not contested along partisan lines. So as many people know, there was a statute enacted to prohibit the operation of the TikTok social media network. A couple of years ago, the deadline for that statute's implementation was just before the inauguration. Days prior to that, the US Supreme Court upheld the ban on TikTok under the First Amendment. And one of the first executive orders extends a pause on the ban. The interesting point about that executive order, though, is it says that, well, at the end of the pause, when the statute that would ban TikTok goes into effect, the president directs every member of the executive branch to not enforce the statute. So the executive order contains within it a direction from the president to ignore, to nullify the statute. That has not been the traditional understanding of how the distribution of legal authority in the United States works. It's not the only example, but I think it's a nice example because it's a relatively nonpartisan one. It's not one that implicates, I think, some of the disputes that Democrats and Republicans have. The second way in which the executive orders are, I think, genuinely distinctive is that they manifest or they are an effort at concentrating legal and policymaking authority in the presidency in a way that I think is different and distinct from anything that Congress anticipated in the way that the statutes that describe the administrative state set forth, or in a way that previous administrations have intimated. The best example of this is the executive order that was issued last week that eliminates some of the autonomy possessed by so-called administrative agencies, particularly independent administrative agencies, and pulls that power into the presidency. If there was time, or I would spin out an example of that, but I'll just put the example on the table, which is one of the agencies that is affected by last Thursday's executive order is the Federal Reserve. And I would submit that the way that the Federal Reserve is treated in that executive order is not consistent with the broadly shared understandings of central bank independence globally.
Well, let me bring that down to the oi polloi level. They say, Trump says, okay, you people made me head of the executive branch. And I guess traditionally, supposedly, the SEC, FCC, FTC, FEC, CFTC, CFPB, FERC, FDIC, and the Federal Reserve have been independent, meaning they answer to nobody. And Trump is saying, I answer to the voters. That's my responsibility. And therefore, I want to run. I want to take control of that. And I kind of understand it. And you know, Alan, part of the thing of this flood the zone, the flurry of activity, is about contrast. First contrast with 2016, Trump, I think nobody was more amazed that Trump won than Trump. And he wasn't prepared. And he had and it was a miserable beginning to his first term. So there's the contrast with that. But then there's the contrast with the Biden administration. Biden was absent. We don't know who was president on bad days. And it was dead quiet most of the time. And so Trump, again, wanted to change the dialogue, wanted to change the competitive dialogue as this deal maker and say this new sheriff in town. And I think that's been accomplished. And I think, you know, when my Democratic friends, and I have many, complain about Trump, I kind of push back and say, well, why then did the Democrats basically engineer his nomination? He was contending in the Republican primaries in 2004, but he was not dominating. DeSantis and Haley were in there very strongly. And then suddenly came these flurry of indictments from Alvin Bragg and Letitia James, who'd promised to get Trump for something, and Fani Willis, and on. And suddenly the spotlight was on him, and he certainly knows how to deal with that. And the mugshot became his campaign poster. So, I mean, that helped establish him as the candidate. And we're told by experts that that's exactly what the Democratic hierarchy, whoever the hell they are, wanted. They wanted Trump because they thought they could beat him.
Do you know leaders who, regardless of where they live or what they do, are changing the world? Leaders who are not content with what is and are working hard for what could be. Leaders with both a demonstrated track record and the potential for continued impact. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values, and global in approach or implication. If so, please nominate them for the Telberg SNF Eliason Global Leadership Prize at telbergprize.org. The nominations will be open from March 15th to May 15th. Thank you. Let's circle back to where we were going and are going, checks and balances. As Aziz, you've been nudging up to that line. Clearly there is, and there's a number of questions from the audience about where the hell is the Congress? Is the Congress a check or a balance? I actually would like also to talk about the legal system, the counterpart to a record number of executive orders is a record number of judicial filings. I checked with justsecurity.org, which I recommend as a source. And at least as of the weekend, they documented 90 complaints in some stage of adjudication, either filed, not yet responded to by a judge, or responded to by a judge and moving on through the system. The Supreme Court yet to be heard from, but it's only 5 weeks into this, and then the Supreme Court will be heard from sooner or later. So let's talk about checks and balances. It's a bit like watching an American football game. We have the team has gotten the ball. They scored on the first drive. Okay, now we're about to have something else happen. Do you, start with disease, do you expect that this pushback, either from the Congress, although the Democrats are in a minority, or through the judicial system, is going to begin reestablishing some sense of balance?
On Congress, no. On the courts, mostly no, but a little bit, yes. On Congress, again, political scientists provide a useful benchmarking for this purpose. In the last 30 years, one of the points that political scientists have underscored is the weakening of institutional loyalties on the part of members of Congress and the growing strength of partisan loyalties among those same that same population. That's driven by geographic sorting in the electorate and the resulting growing importance of the primary rather than the general election. In a world in which people are concerned not about losing to the other party, but about losing to the more marginal, more radical member of their own party in a primary, their behavior is going to predictably change. And when individual legislators' behaviors predictably change, the behavior of the Congress as a whole is going to change. So Congress is not going to play a significant role, at least outside of the budget debates, in checking or constraining or channeling, whatever the verb you want to use is, the Trump administration, because of the basic logic of electoral politics in an era of geographic sorting and high levels of partisanship.
To underline that point, just very quickly, we've been moving in that direction for some time. The Congress is becoming almost like a parliament with whips. Everybody votes. If it's a Democrat, they all vote for the Democrats. Republican, they all vote for the Republican. You're well north of 95% in terms of the typical voting behavior of either party in either body.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then let me quickly say something about the courts, because I know you want to get to move the conversation on. I think that there's a conventional wisdom that because Trump appointed 3 of the 9 U.S. Supreme Court justices, another 3 are appointees from Republican presidencies. And to be fair, he's had a good run at the court on issues that I think surprised many legal experts. There's an expectation that whatever happens in the trial courts, which are called district courts, and then the appeals courts, that the president will sweep the board at the level of the Supreme Court. I hesitate before embracing that conclusion. I certainly think that there are questions of law where Trump is pushing on an open door with respect to the Supreme Court. I think the most important of those is the president's power to remove subordinate officials within the executive branch. This is the core of what is among scholars known as the unitary executive theory. I think that Trump is not pushing at an open door, is actually going to meet a point of some resistance when it comes to the claims that have been made with respect to the president's power to impound money, not to spend funds that have been appropriated and directed by statute without any residue of discretion in the part of the presidency. In fact, it's been the conservative justices in recent cases who have insisted with the greatest fervor that the power to direct funding is a congressional and not an executive authority. And so at least unless those justices flip, and that's not a, entirely beyond the bounds of possibility. At least some of Trump's claims with respect to the flow of money, I think, are going to run into some resistance in the at the level of the Supreme Court.
But you can imagine, I mean, in game theory, and by the way, I agree with everything Aziz just said, but you can easily imagine that Trump feels that he just wants to push this thing to the Supreme Court, any of those decisions, because he's got a better chance there than almost anywhere else. And we'll see. I think there'll be win some, lose some, but that clearly is in his favor. Again, as he said, he's had a good run. He's got a very sympathetic court to most of his views. So I think he'll keep pushing. You know, Trump, the businessman, always seemed to have 14 or 15 lawsuits going on at any given moment. So I'm not, that certainly doesn't deter him. And particularly when he believes as you push and push, you eventually end up in a much more sympathetic group, but maybe not. We'll see. But that's, and Congress, I mean, one of the things in politics is obviously you want to position yourself in a certain way, but ideally in a campaign, you want to position the opposition. And this has happened brilliantly. I mean, Trump came in 16, as I said, with no particular plan. This time there was a plan. Maybe it's Project 2025, but there's discipline. And Susie Wiles, his chief of staff, is remarkably effective at enforcing some discipline and a lot of discipline in this White House. And they're moving fast for good reason, I think. As I said, I think if he's looking at 2 years, not four, in terms of needing to get things done. So that's realistic. But there's, I think he will continue to push on all those things.
So I have an unfair question for both of you, which my progressive friends would not forgive me if I didn't ask. We will eventually see some court actions, court decisions, probably Supreme Court decisions, as you both just said. Odds are the administration wins some, loses some. In your judgments, do you think Trump will obey the court if, in fact, he loses on an issue that he deems as critical?
Look, we do have the first 4 years to look at, and when he was supposedly going to destroy the United States and rip up the Constitution and failed to do so.
He is trying harder this time. Just I have to interject. But anyhow, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I don't know. Again, as I said earlier, the American people are don't have the hallowed feeling for the Constitution right now. Although I think if they were asked, they would certainly stand in, and say he must, abide by that. But their sense of the need for change, their sense of the system being rigged against them, their sense that things just aren't fair, is very, very strong. And that's a great reason why the Democrats lost so resoundingly. 89% of counties in the United States shifted right in the 24 elections, down ticket. Trump's own victory was not, the margin was not so great, but the breadth of it was, he contended in every county in the United States. And as I say, I'm not sure he captured the whole change vote. So I think he's got great power to push, but I don't see him, I honestly don't see him as a character, who wants to be king. I'm 80 this year. There's never been a president who in his first few months in my lifetime did not have the thought that, gee, things would be a lot better if I were king. but I don't, I don't think he's grabbed for that power. I don't have that impression.
But to push you, do you think he would challenge the court and not execute a decision made by the court?
I don't know from the past behavior, honestly, But no, I don't believe that he would challenge the court.
Is he?
I think I would say I would make three discrete observations that I hope add up to an answer. The first is I do think that public views of the Constitution and public views of constitutional fidelity make a difference and are, for political reasons, a constraint on actors, including the president. But coming from England, having grown up in England, I see a parallel between the views of the English, and I'm saying English, not British, the views of the English about the monarchy are structurally similar to the views of Americans about the Constitution. That is, the English revere the monarchy as a kind of abstraction, while simultaneously having a kind of discomfort, in some cases distaste, even repugnance for particular members of the monarchy. So it's perfectly, and I think that captures a little bit of what Scott is describing about Americans' view of the political system as a whole. There is a sense of reverence, of shared history, of belonging that is created by the Constitution in its abstraction. But that can actually live alongside, as a practical matter, the kind of discontent and the kind of anger at the failure of the political and economic systems that Scott's describing. So the constraint that's imposed by public opinion, I think, is a very complex one that depends upon how people are thinking about the Constitution at a given moment in time. I think that complexity must be understood against a second factor, which is that although people talk about decisions to obey or not to obey as a binary, as a do or don't do dichotomy, that's not the way that court orders work. The question of whether one complies with a court order is often a matter of degree, not a matter of absolutes. It often is blurry rather than clear whether compliance has occurred. And indeed, in the ordinary run of cases in which agency actions are challenged by the government, often there are patterns of partial non-compliance, of foot dragging, of unclarity, of seeking, of drawing on further appeals rights and the like, that make it really hard to say, is this compliance or is it not? So I think that the debate about whether compliance with a court order is going to happen is in some sense a misleading and a debate based upon false premises. I think that there is a large gray zone between compliance and non-compliance. And I think that, in fact, we live most of the time as lawyers in the gray zone. And I see no strong reason to think we will be outside the gray zone in this case. Here's a last observation. If you think about the policy victories that have been achieved by the conservative wing of the Republican Party over the last 5 or 10 years, many, not all, but many, take the form of U.S. Supreme Court opinions. I'm thinking here particularly of the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the decision about affirmative action, and the various decisions about the ways in which administrative agencies can or should behave. In challenging the U.S. Supreme Court's authority over constitutional questions, or if he were to challenge it, Trump would be challenging the institutional pedestal upon which many of the conservative movement's principal achievements over the last 10 years rest. And I'm not sure that fact, the fact that there is a baby with the bathwater, so to speak, has sunk in yet. Because a world in which the president does not heed Supreme Court opinions may well be a world in which Congress and governors and ordinary people do not heed Supreme Court opinions. And I'm not sure that's a world that in the aggregate is better for the Trump White House than the world as it stands today.
But I'd like to go back to this question of independent agencies, because it strikes me, whether it's the Fed or any of the other alphabet agencies, really, really quite important, since one could imagine a case in either direction that whether the you want independence in terms of specific kinds of arguments, in terms of what the SEC does to avoid corruption, in terms of what the Fed does to avoid corruption, et cetera, et cetera. But also in a democracy, you want democratic control, small d, of these agencies. That issue has not been put as directly as it's being put for a long time, although certainly when Franklin Roosevelt was president, he put it with exclamation points in a number of cases. So it's been around American politics for a long time. How do you, each of you, think about how independent ought independent be in a democracy?
The fact is, they're part of the executive branch. The head of the executive branch is a guy named Donald Trump. He was elected to do that. He sees as his responsibility how those agencies spend their money, you know, or what decisions they made. Traditionally, those agencies, while independent, have followed the policy directions and directives of the administration, whoever it is, all these administrations back. I can't think of many where they've gone on their own way. But Trump is simply saying, and I think this does have a general appeal to voters, that says, hey, somebody's got to control this stuff, and I'm it.
I have a slightly different view of this, which is premised upon a reading of the Constitution that I think was generally shared up until maybe 10 years ago. And I think that reading of the Constitution starts out with a supposition or an assumption that is, I think, being contested by this administration. And I think it's worth surfacing first the supposition as a way of identifying what's really at stake. The supposition is that democracy is a project that unfolds over time. Democracy is not a project that can be reduced to a single moment in time, such as an election. It is not the case that one person, one vote, one time is an accurate description of a democracy. Instead, the way that the democratic scheme under the US Constitution, like many others, is meant to unfold, is that democracy is a process that involves two kinds of unfolding processes over time. The first is that a body of people who are elected enshrine their judgments about public policy in laws. And it has always been the case that those laws do not terminate, they do not expire at the end of a given Congress. They are durable. At the same time, there is a second process that goes on, which is there are elections not just once, but many times. And through those elections, the people have the capacity and the opportunity to change their mind. They can change their mind about who sits in Congress, and they can change their mind about who sits at the cockpit of the executive branch. But whoever or whenever they change their mind, particularly about who is at the head of the executive branch, that shift in judgment is not a license to slough off all of the accrued obligations that have been democratically generated and congealed, distilled down into the form of binding laws. I think that interplay between the products of democracy that take the form of laws, laws that are necessary, in my judgment, for the operation of a market economy, of the basic peace of mind that people have under the rule of law. I think that the shift that this administration is undertaking is a repudiation of the authority of that binding law in the name of a single election.
It wasn't that long ago that, at least I never thought of Washington being corrupt. Maybe stupid, maybe dumb, maybe misguided, but do you think that Washington is now corrupt?
I agree completely with your assessment of the state of public opinion about Washington, that it's a standard view that political elites are disconnected, responsive to a narrow interest group of the wealthy, and are not responsive to the views of the broad mass of the public. And I think that that is understood as a species of corruption, where politicians are non-responsive. I think that that public view bleeds into a set of concerns about quid pro quo, or what a lawyer might describe as corruption in the sense of a set of acts that constitute bribery, that constitute a failure to honestly perform a public service, that would be punishable by the criminal law. I think the two things that I would point out as being salient there, the two policy changes that I think are salient there, are first the Justice Department's announcement that it will no longer enforce the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This is the American criminal statute that forbids bribery of foreign officials. Going along with that is a second policy change, which is the firing of the officials within the executive branch who are specifically responsible for identifying, bringing to light, and even in some instances facilitating the prosecution of actual cases of bribery or quid pro quo corruption. This is officers such as the inspector generals, who are supposed to identify instances of fraud, corruption, and waste within government. Almost all, 18, I believe, have been terminated. It's hard to see why, if you are interested in reducing fraud in government, the first thing you would do is eliminate the officers that do, in fact, police fraud in government. So in a world in which the mechanisms through which criminal corruption are being dismantled, and I think it's just as a generalization fair to say that we're seeing a lot more evidence of potential corruption out there in the dealings of people within the administration, it's hard to see how we're not going to see more criminal corruption in the near term.
It's an unfair question to ask as we run towards the end here, and I want to come to the rest of the world in a second. Do you think there's a possibility, for all the wrong reasons, that Trump might in fact get people to begin trusting government again, exactly by demonstrating that he's changing so much?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific thought. Whatever you think the substance of the changes that Trump is making, perhaps the most important effect is that he is appearing to radically change government. And by appearing to radically change government, he will reinstall or reignite a shared trust in government. I think that's a possibility. I think it's probably not going to happen. And one thing that I would look at in making evaluations of whether it's likely to happen is what's going to happen to the tail risks. And I think that if one of these many kinds of tail risks emerges, if we see some catastrophic outbreak of an illness, if we see a cybersecurity breakdown of catastrophic or grave proportions, if we see a geopolitical crisis that the president struggles to deal with because he doesn't have advisors with depth of knowledge in the geopolitical sphere, then I think that all bets are off with respect to this project of trying to if you think it is a project of trying to rebuild trust in government, then I think it will plainly go off the rails.
This is a terrifically important point, because I would argue what you describe as tail risks are not particularly far out in the tails. The question is this. When the United States has a crisis, the tendency to become autocratic is not far below the surface. And we saw it most famously during World War II. We saw it during the Depression. We saw Roosevelt suspend habeas corpus. Extraordinary decision. We saw Lincoln in the Civil War similarly act. So if we have these big, perhaps low probability, big consequence events, the odds of an autocratic response, at least historically, are quite high, with all sorts of arguments about that's how we need to mobilize the resources, et cetera, et cetera.
I think a lot depends upon the kind of crisis. And so, for example, compare the response of Lincoln at the beginning of the Civil War to the response of Roosevelt when he comes into office in the throes of the Great Depression. There are arguments that both of them exercise profoundly extra-legal, even illegal kinds of authority. So Lincoln, on the one hand, as you said, suspends habeas corpus, refuses to comply with a judicial order from Roger Tawney, the U.S. Supreme Court's Chief Justice, with respect to the release of a particular detainee. Roosevelt, on the other hand, announces a bank holiday, which he has no authority to do. He goes off the gold standard. He says that we're not going to pay debts that the U.S. has accrued where there is a clause in the contract that requires the payment of the debt in gold. We're just going to repudiate all of those contracts. Those are extraordinary kinds of legal claims that, as you say, emerge out of an emergency. But they have very, very different kinds of political effects. The kind of politics that's generated by a geopolitical emergency and the kind of politics that's generated by a financial emergency, I think, are very, very different. I don't quite know what to make or how to think about the politics of a public health emergency. I think that those have radically changed over the last 5 years as a consequence of COVID and as a consequence of the polarized reactions to some of the COVID, the prophylactic measures taken against COVID. And it's just not clear to me how those kinds of emergencies are going to reshape politics. Although I do agree profoundly with your view that they will reshape politics in some way, shape, or form.
We are running up to the end of our time. So let me ask a question that's being asked repeatedly in the questions and answers. And it has to do with what comes after Trump. One point of view is Trump comes after Trump, hence his mumbling out loud about yet another term. One is that Trump has so profoundly destroyed the Democratic Party and the Republican Party that maybe parties reshape and reform, which from my point of view would be a wonderful outcome. But as you, and again, we're only 5 weeks into this, so who knows what we're going to be talking about 5 months into this.
The question is Trump the end of something or the beginning of something? And I there's lots of indications that he's the beginning of something. The Democratic Party that I was a part of, the hairy armed sons of and daughters of toil, the blue collar party, the party of minorities, is no longer. It's a party of white, urban, advanced degree professionals. And that's the base of the party. That's no longer the party that it was. The Republicans are only Trump. So the real, it's a great question, Alan. What happens? Trump won't be able to go on. I'm an optimist. But I am also an optimist that this may be the beginning of a new era, and that era will be one of reform, and 28 will be the year that a great, either a new party, and a new party won't exist unless there's a new candidate, will arise.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to what Scott said. I think that on both sides the principal parties in the United States have become, in a sense, hollowed out, and that there is at a moment of kind of institutional zombiehood at the party level, the possibility of quite radical change in the nature of partisan division and partisan engagement in the United States. And I think you see the Democrats realizing this. I think that the Republicans have sort of glimpsed it in the past, but have not yet, but have been able to forestall it in various ways. And I think that that forestalling is not going to endure through a second Trump presidency. And I don't know what will come in terms of party formations after this, but it won't be the same as what has preceded it. The other thing that I would flag as being different is I think that once the claims that I've described that are made on behalf of presidential power, both in the domestic domain, and many of the questions I know have been about the foreign domain, and we haven't really talked about the geopolitical consequences. Once those claims are made, and made at least partially successfully, I think that they're basically impossible to undo. And so whatever changes are wrought to the separation of powers are not undoable, in my view. And I think it's quite possible that Trump leaves us with a constitutional system that is profoundly and very meaningfully different from the one that we had even 2 months ago. And I don't know what that system is going to look like, and I don't know whether it's one that is going to prove as durable as the one that came before.
Unfortunately, we have reached the witching hour, so I want to end today's conversation with three final thoughts. First, as Scott said a few moments ago, we seem to be nearer the beginning than the end of something. I think we are entering a world where almost everything we know is going to be changing, and that imposes an obligation on the Telberg Foundation to explore that world with you, our audiences. We will do that. Secondly, I urge you to engage with us this year as we launched the 2026 version of the Telberg SNF Eliason Global Leadership Prize and the Telberg Leaders Mentoring Leaders Program. You can find details of both at telbergfoundation.org. And finally, I want to thank our guests today, Aziz Hook and Scott Miller, for the conversation we've just enjoyed. I also want to thank you, the audience, for joining us today and hopefully in future conversations. Thank you and good day. Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.